Gabe, welcome to the Bainbridge podcast.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Probably hearing my dog barking in the background, so apologies.
That sounds good. Dave Wardell, I've been really excited about this conversation because you had this inside view and instrumental view, along with the founders of Chubbies, of one of like the big successes of the D2C space over the past few years. And I think I'm really excited to talk about, you know, how you built those processes, the discipline you instilled or helped instill at that brand. And then, you know, how you had your big success in getting acquired by Solo. And then kind of like maybe we even could talk a little bit about, you know, your experience at Solo.
Cool.
But why don't we start, because I'm going to not do justice to your background. Like, how did you even get, you know, to Chubbies? And like, where did you start your career?
Yeah. No, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on, Ben. Big fan of what y'all are building. And I think, obviously, it's come through some of our conversations previously, but I think it's cool that there's a lot of overlap between the software that you're building and some of the more manual or stitched together systems and processes that we had at Chubbies. So I eventually was Chubbies brand president after we merged into Solo Brands, and prior to that CFO for a handful of years, prior to that VP of finance, director of finance. Frankly, when I got hired as director of finance, it's a fairly lofty title. I was doing a lot of everything. You know, took over from the founders, writing checks by hand to our vendors. Second day on the job was out pitching VC with Kyle, one of the founders, to raise capital, building models from scratch, revising them time and time and time again when inevitably a sales channel changed or something changed with how we were approaching budgeting for marketing or fulfillment or what have you. And that's probably the story of our time there, is just continuously reinventing and reevaluating. You know, we were founded back in 2011, early Shopify Plus customer. Wasn't even Shopify Plus then, I believe. And so we were part of that earlier wave where you're really figuring out what does it mean to be one of these companies. A lot of VC money was pouring in. A lot of people trying to treat it and apply some of the same principles from SaaS investing into it, right. And looking at, you know, LTV like it's a recurring revenue stream. I think since then, people have come to understand some of the fundamentals, such as every single time that someone comes back to purchase, you're probably having to convince them to do so. And so fundamentally not the same as having that in a contract. That scale that we built to was slowly but surely. I think if I go back, so much of it has to do with the founders' mindsets, all of them very financially literate individuals. All of them cared about us operating the business sustainably, not sustainably in terms of environmentally, but sustainably in terms of cash flows, profits, things like that, right? Not going negative on contribution at acquisition point was the first original kind of line that we drew in the sand to say we need to operate responsibly. And that was them really understanding that we had to continue to get people to come back and purchase from us, but that we couldn't lose money up front or else right. We would go into a deep cash flow hole. That was advice from some other people who were even, you know, before us in the D2C e-com world, who had done things, I don't know, let's say, for lack of a better term, incorrectly, going really deep into discounting or super high acquisition costs on that first purchase, and then having to have the entirety of their profits driven by those future future retention, which you know, is unpredictable, especially in fashion and apparel, whether you're going to have someone come back.
But just in case people don't know the brand or aren't super familiar with the brand, maybe give a little bit of the founding story, like, you know, because it is such an iconic idea, very true. The founders had a very clear vision that you really got a sense of the founders from that vision. But it might also, I want to get into the details of what you were just talking about, but I want to make sure people understand what you're selling.
Yeah, and I'll try and weave how I got involved into that. So 2007-08, founders are graduating from Stanford. You know, Facebook, early days, no real ads on there, Instagram becoming a thing. And the thought was first, like, what a unique time to be able to speak directly to the customer, create community, create relationships, talk to this customer like it's one of your buddies in the group text. And it iterated and spun out from there, but it was trying to find the right kind of product, the right kind of brand mix and messaging that resonated, that felt relatable. You know, that idea was always to have a bit of a bigger lifestyle brand around it, but Short Shorts, as it happened, was that initial first product. I don't think anyone assumed how big of a business we'd be able to create off of core 5.5-inch inseam cotton shorts, but it really took off, and so it was off to the races from there. Each of the four founders eventually kind of quit their jobs and started working on it full time. I was living in San Francisco at the time with a couple of them, and thinking about what I want to do next in life. I was at PwC. I had done a spin in audit. I had done a spin in the M&A due diligence and consulting group. Mm-hmm. Knew that I wanted to move on from that. Had some great opportunities there and learned a ton, a really good basis, but realized I didn't want to be a partner and I wanted to be more of an operator. My mom is a CFO, or recently retired, but was a CFO of a large construction company. And so I really looked up to how she built her career. And once I actually got into PwC, I understood a lot more about what it was she actually did. And so that was kind of the goal. And I was trying to figure out how to get there. Business school I was applying to, and thankfully one of my roommates was reading my application and took it to Kyle, who would eventually be my boss, one of the founders, and said, "Hey, do we need someone filling this role?" Which was, I was basically trying to sell myself as a director of finance eventually, post business school. So really worked out well. And at that time we were probably 10, 12 people. We were fulfilling all in-house, and growth was starting to take off. And I think the founders got some advice that was very fortunate for me from an early investor, same person who talked about not going too deep into the hole on your acquisition, around investing earlier than you would potentially otherwise think to in like a good finance and accounting function. Nice. And so thankfully, I happened to be right place, right time, and jumped in head first. I wouldn't say I always had dreamed or imagined that I would be working in fashion, selling men's shorts, but it was a great opportunity to jump into the startup scene, and that was with some friends and some really, really intelligent, driven people. So that's kind of where it happened. And then as we started to grow, Chubby started to explore new opportunities, right? New categories, new sales channels, you know, open up our own stores, try and pop up shops in Washington, D.C. in the middle of the winter. Shout out to John Mark, who manned that store and stayed at one of the founders' parents' houses for a couple months. Turns out that, you know, when you only have shorts to sell, in DC in the middle of snow season is probably not the best, P&L that you're going to be driving, out of a single location, but, learned a lot from that. And eventually, you know, a lot of those learnings led to a thriving stores business.
Why did you guys decide to expand product lines and distribution channels? I mean, was it, hey, we need more growth, or we see an opportunity? Like, was it, let's throw some stuff at the wall and see what sticks, or was it really premeditated? You know,
a mix. You know, we were still learning a lot then. This is 2014, and you know, Wild West days of social digital advertising. But we could already start to see on the stores example, right? And even on category expansion, we could already start to see some of those costs rising. The early arbitrage of acquiring a customer into your community, you know, liking your page, becoming a fan, and then converting them into a customer, that arbitrage was already starting to show signs of going away. We had some great early success with that, but that was showing signs of going by the wayside as more people figured that out, as more dollars from big advertisers started to pour in as, you know, tests at first. So some of that is just finding balance, finding physical ways of acquiring customers, you know, the good old school stuff. A lot of it is, you know, trying to take some of the things that worked in traditional retail and not reinvent the wheel, right? Like category expansion can be directly tied to lifetime value, right? The more items you have to message about in an e-commerce environment, the more reasons you have for a customer to come back and purchase from you, the higher lifetime value you're going to effectively drive on average over time. And really the higher the profit and sustainable growth that you can drive. The kicker there though, right, is there's always a balance and some of those tests don't work. And so how do you do that intelligently? What metrics do you use to inform that? And that's what took years and years and years between marketing and merchandising and finance and what have you to try and figure out.
So you had some really, you were lucky to get some good advice early on from this investor who was like, hey, invest in finance and accounting and earlier than you think. Your founders, you said, were highly financially literate. So they cared about this. And then another good piece of advice was like, you know, be super careful about your acquisition costs, right? Like, which was kind of counter to what the market was saying at the time, you know, sort of like go, 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 right? Make up for it in the LTV. So what specific, did you have like a, I cut you off at the very beginning, but I think you were talking about like maybe a metric that you had that for acquisition costs. It was like what had to be greater than contribution profit, or was that where you were going?
Yeah. I mean,
or below contribution
profit. That's where we started. It evolved, you know, and we would come to test the upper bounds. can we spend through stagnating growth to spur more business? Like maybe in some advertising channels that works, not in Facebook, where the algorithm is so perfected to every incremental dollar you spend typically is going to be less efficient. So you know, some of those lessons we learned the hard way. But we had great key people. You know, there was one investor that gave us a few of those tidbits because they had been through it. But I think we did some smart stuff around the people that we brought in the early days that invested in us. We did not, you know, seek maximizing valuation above all else. We had some incredible strategic investors. It's strategic in the sense of not that these are, you know, future corporate acquirers, strategic in the sense of, you know, there's someone who had built many supply chains of fashion companies. There was someone who had been a CFO, COO of large retailers. And so we had them chirping at us about certain things. You know, one of them we had in every single financial close meeting. You know, he was an advisor as well. He was in every single financial close meeting and demand planning meeting that I think we ever had from 2014 onwards. I mean, he was instrumental in asking tough questions, right? This is a seasoned CFO, an investor advisor in multiple businesses, and we were very open with him. He was in all of those meetings. He could join our weekly calls when we wanted to. We had a great relationship, really trusting with him. And he taught us the hard questions to ask and did not shy away from it. You know, as soon as we, you know, one month it would be, we were too heavy on inventory and asking us why, and then we would have had a pickup in sales rate. And his question next month is like, okay, so you must be, you know, missing some inventory or going to have some gaps. Where are they? How are you correcting that situation, right? And so, you know, there was a there's a really good diversity of talent and experience on the team. You know, we had some of those types of operators. We had a bunch of people internally from Gap and Abercrombie and other brands that knew how big retailers operated with open to buys and merchandising approaches. But we also had a lot of people that hadn't ever been, you know, like myself, in fashion before. And so it's always a good balance and debate. We always have plenty of people talking about, hey, this is kind of retail, fundamental retail math, and people right there at the table willing to push back and say, yeah, sure, but that's predicated upon, you know, 200 stores or a wholesale approach. That doesn't take into account the information that we can learn and glean from our customers online by running an advertising test. So it was always that push. All, I think we had a really good balance and an appreciation and respect for dissension, for contradiction at that table. So that's from a, how do we get there? There's a big cultural emphasis on that, a big cultural emphasis on building consensus and hearing contradictory questions and information. You know, whether we chose to eventually go that path or not, that's ultimately was, you know, each functional leader's kind of decisions, you know, CEO's decision. But we were always open to it from a cultural perspective. In terms of shifting to a little bit more of the hard metrics, the very first kind of metric we ever had on marketing was every single week I was sitting down and updating how much did we spend on all of our channels, and at that point fairly narrow, mostly just Facebook, and how many customers did we acquire, and what was our gross margin estimated to be, and such, and figuring out were we contribution positive or negative on the on new customer purchases.
So you were doing, you know, this,
so trying to isolate.
Okay, so this is like this is interesting. This is kind of the beginning, one of the beginnings of your processes that you hone. So you're on like what, a Friday or something, you were looking at the previous week and doing those calcs?
Started as every single Monday. That was the first thing I was doing. For the prior week, Sunday through Saturday, we were operating on a retail calendar. And I was trying to get those over to Tom, founder and who led, you know, digital and marketing as quickly as possible, so that we understood where we were at. Did we go too deep? Do we have room left in the, along those lines? And, you know, could we spend down to effectively zero every single week on new customer acquisition? And then, you know, as a, I would say, not afterthought, but like secondary measure, you know, what were we spending on repeat marketing? How profitable was that? What did that business look like? Are we trending towards our cohort model or not? First iteration, super raw with like a really, you know, just blending total marketing spend over new customers. That was the basis for it. And I think that's how a lot of people have looked at it in the past. And what we learned over the years, right, is how to fine tune that, how to segment out, first of all, new and repeat spend. Some of that is more art than science, but, coming up with assumptions and logic that makes sense, much like people do when they're figuring out attribution on a marketing channel. If they apply any kind of multiple, usually that's loosely based on some math and mostly based on gut and logic, unless you have some incredibly expensive tools and incredibly, incredibly smart data scientists that you're paying. Starting out with that big blended number, I would credit, give a ton of credit, again, like very financially literate team driven top down by the founders. Our marketing team, led by Tom, wanted to understand incrementality over time. Like that's where we eventually got to, was, you know, realizing, hey, these dollars that we're spending through holdout tests and through other, you know, kind of turning on and off budgets and things like that, that I won't get into too much in the tactics, partially because I'm not that literate in them myself. But I got really comfortable that, hey, some of these incremental dollars we're spending, the last customer that we're acquiring, we're spending $100 on, right? You know, you've got to assume that you're acquiring some for zero, effectively. And so that was how we started to, I would say, to turn the ship and really start to understand what we can afford to spend. You know, eventually we would get to a place where we had tied it into what is our cohort model? How quickly do we want to be generating X dollars of profit in the lifetime value of an average customer? You know, for us, 90 days was a sweet spot.
How did you come to that? I mean, that's pretty sophisticated. Yeah. I mean, how did you decide that?
I would say two ways. One, that's a mark of a season, and we were seasonal items and seasonal goods, right? Right. You know, we're launching stuff on a quarterly basis. So, you know, some of it just stems from that. It's kind of a natural place to set, like, hey, are we maximizing each quarter? But a lot of it was also taking the now 6-7 years of cohort model history that we had, applying CACs and what we called CPR, cost per repeat order, to that cohort model, that order base of cohort model, applying some basic other margin structure, gross margin, fulfillment margin to it, and saying, hey, if we play to these metrics across this year and see, you know, this growth in new customers and this kind of performance in repeat, what kind of contribution profits are we going to generate? We know what our fixed costs are planned at. Are we hitting the kind of profit margin that we need to?
Yeah.
And so that kind of sets the initial target, and that, you know, you run in that cohort model on a monthly basis. Then when you get into operating, that's when you're trying to like inch those things up. Can we get another, you know, that CPR then is inherently tied to, or sorry, CPA or CAC is inherently tied to an assumption around the amount of repeat revenue that you're going to drive from a customer now, because you've averaged it out over, you know, you've pegged that into a full annual view that a cohort model is driving of your revenue and profits. Yeah. So let's say you have a $50 CAC and that's your kind of baseline any given month. Now you know what your other variables are that you can start to use to inform whether that's, you know, you can inch that up or you got to drop that down if you're really focused on profit and profitable growth. So
yeah,
as you see repeat increase, as you see, you know, reorder rates increase, you have more room in your CAC inherently, because you're outperforming that cohort model. It's a lagging indicator, right? Measuring customers you acquired 60, 90 days beforehand. But yeah, I think that's where like we have some, we really saw, I think, around the corner and started applying some of those types of models earlier. Yeah. And eventually got into a place, right, where that was core to our weekly reporting. That was in our, you know, the all of the dashboards we needed to manage all of that was in built into either like one spreadsheet plus Looker with all the assumptions, so that it was hopefully just 15, 20 minutes for a couple people to update, usually ideally twice a week, so that we could make tweaks and adjustments. And then, you know, a lot of the, you know, more sweeping assumptions, those were still built in on, you know, daily reporting, so that the marketing team in particular could understand, you know, with a CAC that we had helped them translate into ROAS, how are they operating?
How did you?
A lot of buzzwords, you know, there. Sorry, that's a lot of.
Go ahead. What?
A lot of acronyms and buzzwords there.
No, it's awesome, and I'm like, one of the things that I was really impressed at when I read the Solo S1, you know, they had to share some data about Chubbies and the margin structure. And you guys had a really, by the point of the acquisition, I think if I remember correctly, you guys were like in the mid or high 30s EBITDA margin. Does that sound right?
Yeah, probably. That probably was our first half pro forma, okay. I bet. For 6 months of the year, that sounds probably about right. So yeah.
Were you, To get there, was that like a conscious thing? Like you guys were saying like, hey, I want to be at a 35% EBITDA margin. So you backed all your numbers up from there? Or was it a process of like iterating over time? Like, hey, first we just want to get profitable. Now we want to get to 10%. Now we want to get to 20%. Like how did you think about that?
So yeah, I think our, you know, that sounds right for our front half contribution margin or so. The path to get there was definitely intentional. Started probably 2016, I think. For the first time, we built really a good, like first time I really built a good 5-year, 6-year out strategic model. We had done some really high level ones in the past. This was the first time where we made an effort to really understand each channel, understand the key levers, and use it as a, hey, how do we get to 10% EBITDA margins on an annual basis? Like, what do we need to do to get there? And so it was fascinating. It showed us there was a couple margin structure changes that we needed to make to unlock that. Gross margin being by far the most important. Like, we were just not going to get there unless we brought our gross margin up a whole lot of points. And so that kind of gave us the roadmap. And I think the best thing was is that we rallied around profitability and profit margin as a metric for the entire team. That became our kind of call to action for the whole team. That's what we talked about in our all hands meetings. That's what we talked about in our any kind of monthly touch bases. That's what we talked about at the beginning and end of each year. And so every person at Chubby's, from founders and executives to you know, associates in the stores, everyone knew that profit growth was the most important factor for us.
That's amazing. I mean, this is 2016, right?
Yeah, 2016. We started working on it 2016. We probably started really rallying everyone around it 2017, 2018. It permeated the culture, I would say, by 2018, such that I think 2019, we were finally hitting those, some of the key metrics. Took us then a full year longer than expected, which I guess should be expected to truly turn profitable. But yeah, it was all out team effort, right? Because any given individual, I mean, the beauty of profits and profit margin is that pretty much every single person on the team can affect that. Not every single person on the team can affect sales necessarily, but everyone in what they're doing, if they understand their levers and the order economics of the business, everyone can affect profits. And so, you know, look, like we spent a lot of time trying to educate the team on, hey, what are e-commerce order economics? How is that different from a store's P&L? How is that different from a wholesale P&L? What are the similarities? I'm not going to act like that message always got through to everyone, but we harped on it a lot. And I would like to think that a lot of people really understood what it meant to go from sales down to contribution and what the main components were. Because merchants, right, were not just picking the items we're going to sell in the future. They were reviewing return rates by SKU, by category, and selecting back into intentionally using that as a qualitative criteria at minimum. If not a criteria when a return was really bad, to just strike something in general from the future allocation or assortment, or at least, you know, needed to be reworked dramatically if it was going to make it back in. That's a, you know, in an e-commerce business, that's critical. Our supply chain team completely changed our QC process in a couple different ways. You know, as another example on the returns front, our marketing team were hawks. Like, I mean, what marketing team do you have where you have to go tell them to spend more money sometimes? Like, that's That's unheard of. Those are great. They were phenomenal partners. And so everyone really linked arms. Again, like I you know, this is not pandering. This is like tone at the top years, drilled into everyone's teams, and incredible alignment amongst the founders on that being the most important thing. We didn't know if that was for an exit or if that was just to build the company for 20 years, but we knew that we needed to do that to survive. We knew that that the chickens were going to come home to roost. Hopefully I'm not butchering that saying. And that, you know, the VC well was going to dry up. We knew as operators that these were not businesses that could be, warranting massive revenue multiples. We felt a lot of conviction. And that was, Kyle, using a great investor and kind of resource allocation mindset, our CEO and founder, looking ahead and saying, hey, this market's going to come back to how it was valued before. And so real team effort and great alignment amongst them on, hey, we want to build this the right way. We're going to slow down at times. We're going to accept maybe a little bit slower growth to get our business right, to understand what our baseline is, things like that, that are tough decisions that they took. So
that's really impressive because it, especially during that period, your peer set was the opposite, right? The peer set was like raise lots of money and grow like crazy. And scale profits at some point,
Yeah, the peer set that gets publicity was
okay.
I don't want to act like we were the right. We're not, we're not the only ones seeing this building like this. There's plenty of companies bigger than us, direct to consumer brands that we're close with that never raise any outside capital, bootstrap the whole darn thing. So those are the ones that I have the most immense respect for. Because we were, we were still able to leverage some serious capital and relationships because of that. Yeah. There's the people who raise minimal outside capital, they're ones who are really and grew sustainably are super impressive to me. Some people saw it just wasn't getting much publicity until it did, right? And then all of a sudden, it's funny, the last few years, it's all anyone wants to talk about. So I'm thankful for the team that we had in place across the board. My counterparts who were leading other business functions, incredible partners on that front. And they were all in on it too. Everyone was focused on profitable, sustainable growth and being around and being one of those brands, hopefully that's here in 20, 30, 40 years.
That's awesome. Dave, one of the things, this is January 2023, a lot of companies are worried about cash, growing cash, keeping cash, generating more cash. How did you think about cash at Chubbies, your cash conversion cycle? What were some of the things you learned and put in place?
We had a great debt partner, Dwight Funding. They're really, really good and were a phenomenal partner along the way. And it's funny. Sometimes they told us we were being too conservative, which is just hilarious. It ties back to some of the theme, I think, where we were always really concerned and thoughtful about cash flow and our balance sheet. And how we were building the company, debt capital and leverage is the way to go as long as you're responsible about it. Fund your inventory that way, but make sure that you don't get upside down in your inventory, that you're selling through your goods. I was talking to a seasoned D2C investor, entrepreneur, advisor today. Every DSC brand has the problem of they have their unit, their items that are just flying, their workhorses on digital advertising. that they're going to sell out of, and, you know, and before they get the new stock in. Meanwhile, they have other stuff that is sitting there on the side, you know, lingering, you know, with the slower sell through and longer weeks of supply. And how do you balance that? I mean, that is so hard. Our marketing and inventory planning, constantly balancing that, constantly talking through that. You know, I think inventory planning team did a phenomenal job of creating an environment where we had all the information we needed, to make the right decisions on that front and manage the inventory. I think they really were great partners to us on the finance side of the house. And you know, we certainly spent our fair share of time just trying to, in the earlier years, trying to just reconcile whose number was right. How, like, do we have this unit, what, X units or Y units in this category? And why is this roll forward not working? But as we got systems in place, as we got more mature, in our functions and processes there, we were able to really spend a mass amount of time understanding where those liable inventory areas were. And thanks to, you know, the advisor that I mentioned earlier, always pushing us on that. We focused on, trying to balance and ensure that, those slow movers were not lingering 6 months, 9 months, a year out. Being aggressive there earlier, we learned, was the name of the game. Mm. We learned that the hard way, right? But you know, if you have something slow moving, you know, figuring out ways to repurpose it or promotionally get rid of it at a faster rate. Those are going to be critical to maintain your cash position. You can't just focus on those core winners and expect the other stuff to just magically disappear. Because at the end of the day, right, like, that's just sucking up cash that you should be reinvesting into better buys in the future. So I think, again, it was a long arc of evolution there. You know, we had a nice capital infusion in the early days, and we had some, you know, a great debt partner and revolving line of credit that moved with us. There were plenty of times where we were really tight on cash. And so I think the final piece was just a maniacal, like, weekly cash forecasting habit that I got into, and then you know, my team eventually took over, comparing that to our monthly operating model to try and pick out 3 months, 6 months from now, do we have any differences? If so, why? And hopefully see cash issues around the corner. You know, one more from a top down, one more is bottom up. You're probably not looking 6 months out on that weekly cash flow, but you should be able to see 1, 2, 3 months out, start to see a divergence that indicates, hey, we have some assumptions here off somewhere. And so you should be looking at that every single week when you're doing that weekly cash flow roll forward, and comparing that to your operating cash flow model and saying, what is off? Is this indicative of just, we're, we have some different sales assumptions? That could be fine if you're being more conservative in your monthly operating model than you should be, right? If you're being more conservative than trend and forecasting lower cash and higher inventory in that monthly operating model. But if the opposite's true, well, that weekly cash flow model just saved your bacon, because you're not, you know, you're going to see now, probably, instead of seeing at the next monthly close when you refresh it inevitably, your monthly model, you're seeing it now, and you're able to hopefully start asking the right questions, going and talking to inventory team, talking to your merchandisers and supply chain about orders coming up, and is there inventory we can move in and out? What's our flexibility? Going working with supply chain to talk about, hey, can we get some exceptions and and better terms for the next couple months to help us manage through this. If not, we're going to have to like push out some units or make some changes to other budget items that we had. So a lot of it just becomes problem solving at that point. But I think far too many people do the like diligent weekly cash flow modeling because it's a giant pain in the ass and tedious, and you're getting your information from really completely different places. But such good hygiene.
That's fantastic advice. I think absolutely critical, especially in this year. How did you manage the tension? You talked about wanting to expand lifetime value per customer, adding product views, but then you've also been talking about like, hey, you know, we have slower moving items. We have our kind of hero SKUs that are killing it. Yeah. I think that, you know, in my experience, there's always like a tendency to like, let's add more products. Like, cause that's fun. Right. You know, and like, yeah, but how do you balance that? Cause like, there could be an argument, you know, and a very extreme argument, which would be like, why sell anything besides your hero SKUs, right? Or be very rigorous about testing, you know, like we're only going to test one thing. Where do you think, how do you think brands should think about that?
Yeah, it's tough to say because this is this gets at the like the fundamental success. Like, can you effectively increase your lifetime value through a narrower SKU assortment? Like, how do you do that? If you can do that, you're going to be successful, right? I would say our merchandising, marketing, planning, you know, sourcing development teams, this was what they spent 50 to 75% of their time on was this interplay and interaction.
That's fascinating. Those are big teams. That's a lot of people hours.
Thinking about this, right? With that aim in mind. You know, I think our product teams, right, on the merch design, inventory planning, sourcing, all that, right? They all understood that assortment expansion was around, was inherently LTV focused. And so even the designers at Chubbies like knew or were, you know, had alignment with marketing that it was, you know, what we were looking to do was expand LTV. The tough thing, there's surveying, there's ads with, you know, fake products that lead to signups that you can create. There's surveying of your customers, your team, randoms on the internet, all that stuff. Certainly, you should be doing all of those things. And then you should be looking every year. I mean, our merch team did a phenomenal job at this. And with, you know, a lot of rigor and forcing from planning, but, you know, they really looked hard at like what SKUs were performing versus not, once they applied, cost of goods and such were profitable versus not, using that to inform future buys. Also, when I talk about stuff like this, it's not like we were doing this in 2013. Like, this took years and years and years to develop and hone and put into practice, but you know it's where they eventually were able to build into. And it, you know, there was a year where we went really wide in SKUs, and we learned just what you were talking about, that it doesn't work necessarily always. And so that next year we tightened things up dramatically.
What's been blowing me away is how practical and it's just so unusual. Like, what I'm hearing from you, from what, you know, we sometimes witness with other companies. And I think there's so many people that are trying to build towards this, but I don't know if, I guess like my hope is that we could help accelerate them there. Cause you guys were able, because you had that focus on profitability, you were able to like kind of learn, always live another day, learn, you know, keep going.
Yeah.
But it's like amazing how disciplined you guys were about and intentional you were about so many of these processes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we raised money, but we didn't raise nearly as much as some of our, you know, comps or competitors or what have you. Yeah. So it's on that front, right? There's capital constraint is real. Some of that is forcing function. Some of that is, you know, we had a ton of really, really smart people. A lot of it's just cultural, you know, from Chubby's was always a little against the grain, right? I remember when I first joined, walking around in San Francisco in short, bright neon shorts. You would get people that loved it that walked by, and you would get people outwardly commenting, like just not even shying away from talking trash about what you were wearing. And it wasn't a lot in between, right? And so I think we always felt a little, we always felt fairly comfortable being contrarian and charting our own course. And I definitely think this was part of it. We had some incredible advisors, investors around us. We had founders who like really believed in this and also did the work to get aligned and get their teams on board. You know, I tried to do a lot of work with my team to educate the team at large, and we had an employee base that really rallied around it, that was receptive to it, that believed in, hey, that story and that tie of sustainable, profitable growth is how this is becomes a sustainable kind of heritage brand. And so it all really blended well together, and I'm grateful for, you know, everyone around me, who, you know, at the end of the day, those are all the operators that actually made this happen, right? Made the decisions on the inventory plans we were buying, made the decisions on like what ads they're shutting down versus turning on, and really took the time to think about and understand, like, we wouldn't have accomplished this without them. And it set us up for success, right? It made us stand out when it came time to think about what's the future of the business. Are we going to pursue an exit? Are we going to try and take another sizable investment, growth equity type? How do we want to proceed? It gave us a lot of options and freedom because we had gotten to a cash flow positive place and had such a strong balance sheet that we could, you know, within reason, choose our destiny to a degree, right? You ultimately, yeah, you know, you need to have a dance partner there. But thankfully, you know, we had set ourselves up for success by doing a lot of the hard stuff early. You know, some of those years in there felt like we were wandering the wilderness a bit. It's like, will we ever get to profitability? Like, can we ever create cash flow? There were some dark moments where it's like, goodness, this is a multi-year journey. But thankfully, we had a lot of really committed employees and team members that are phenomenally talented that enabled us to get there.
That's awesome. I think that's a great place to end too. Thank you so much, Dave. And I hope we'll come back and do part two, the exit.
Yeah, perhaps. I'll have to figure out with the powers that be about what can be disclosed versus not. But yeah, that would be great, and really, really enjoyed the time today. So thanks, Ben. Cool.